Welcome to The Brains Behind It, the official podcast of brainhackers.com. The source for smart strategies to improve your life, one brain hack at a time. In this podcast, we talk to the leaders and innovators behind great organizations and find out the secret to their success. Here's your host, editor-in-chief of brainhackers.com and two-time Guinness record holder for memory, Dave Farrow.
Hey there, Brain Hackers. Dave Farrow here. I'm talking with Scott Stevens. He's a prolific author who doesn't mind tackling what you call controversial subjects. And this might not seem very controversial these days, but we're going to be talking about alcohol and the influence of alcohol in the body and his book and his work on, just kind of making people aware of alcohol. And we're going to have a little debate as to, you know, how much is too much. Hey, Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dave. Honored to be here, and thank you for having me as a guest.
I'm happy to have you on as a guest. So tell us the name of your current book on alcohol.
The new book is Look What Dragged the Cat In, The Rise of an Opioid Crisis. This is my fifth one on the topic of alcohol and health. I do write about addiction, the disease of alcoholism, but also taking a broader step with this one and beyond the disease of alcohol addiction or alcoholism, looking at what's perceived today as a public health crisis, and certainly is a tragedy, a crisis, and what alcohol's role in the impetus of that crisis has been.
Yeah, now that's something that I really find fascinating. We can get into like kind of the debate of how much is too much, you know, alcohol, in a little bit. But, you know, starting off, I didn't know of the connection between alcohol and opioid crisis, and from all the evidence that I saw, and I admit probably, you know, propaganda or whatever on the subject, it was, the general consensus was that doctors were being very liberal about subscribing pain relievers. Perhaps the pharmaceutical companies who are in charge of things like Oxycontin and things, you know, big mm-hmm. heavy pain relievers like that, also are guilty of telling these doctors that it's not addictive, that it's certainly not as dangerous as it turns out to be. And so the doctors prescribe it for pain. It goes into the medical trend of treating pain as the fifth vital, vitality. You know, when you take your vitals, the heartbeat and things like that. Now pain level is considered one of them. So that became something that they had to treat. There's a lot of motivation to do that. But as a result, a lot of people got prescription opioids. When the prescriptions ran out, they were still addicted, as the pharmaceutical company said that they wouldn't be, but they were. And that's when they turned to opiates or heroin and things like that. And then we have the crisis that we have today where drug dealers are putting fentanyl in it and things like that. So that whole, like, I guess, train ride right to the opioid crisis, there was no mention of alcohol. So tell me, I mean, I admit to be ignorant of this, so you fill me in. How does alcohol fit into that route?
Well, this train ride may pick up at that station, but let's go back to where the train started. And that's what I've discovered with my research and based the book upon is that 66%, two-thirds of illicit drug users, including those who use opiates, use alcohol as their first drug. And mm-hmm. where do we learn, for the rest of us, the other one-third, where do we learn to take drugs? Where do we learn to self-diagnose and self-dose when it comes to taking something to relieve our pain or to get us somewhere other than where we are right now? And that is with the drug alcohol. So in both of those cases, we have a gateway drug as the drug of first choice. And then the second part of that is we learn to drug. We were groomed to take drugs as a result of our culture's relationship with alcohol.
And it looks now, when you say groomed, though, I would say most people try to get their kids to avoid alcohol. You know, like it seems like I'm certainly your peers will pressure you to drink, but you know, parents and culture usually have, if anything, a negative view of alcohol amongst youth. It isn't part of this nature, not just social conditioning. Isn't it just like young people want to drink or you know want to? It's a part of a party.
And that's exactly the point in the advertising that we do for alcohol. What the alcohol companies do, and they're self-regulated in their advertising, they advertise primarily to those who cannot legally purchase it. There's 14 to 18% of those under 18, those under the age of.
That is true. Yeah. The idea, the imagery, the thought behind the ads are aimed at a pre-drinking audience. You're absolutely right there.
We're selling the sex, we're selling the sizzle, we're selling the conviviality, the joy, the good times, but we're falling desperately short on the actual health consequences of consuming a toxin and known carcinogen. So that's where I come in here, David. And as we were talking prior to the show, I'm not in favor of prohibition. This is not what this book is about, and that's not what I'm about. But I am in favor of a larger dose of education than is taking place today. And I point to the success of the anti-smoking campaigns. When I was born in 1967, 72% of the adult males in this country smoked. And today, 14% smoke. And the reason is we've changed the dialogue from what smoking does for you to what it does to you. And that's where I think we need to be with the direction of where we're talking about or carrying on a dialogue regarding alcohol. And we're already in a sea change right now. We've really stepped up the dialogue over the past 5 years with a Surgeon General's report, not dissimilar to the one that originally condemned smoking.
No, that's true. And actually, the stats show that young people are drinking less and less. It seems to be a bigger trend in North America than in Europe. Europe is heavily, heavily drinking. You know, but I mean, but I do find flaw in some of these things. Maybe I'm kind of part of the old Greek philosophy of nothing in excess, you know, everything in moderation. But abstinence of something means you're missing out on a part of life. So, but I definitely believe that there should be more education. I think specifically around dosing too, understanding how much is too much, how much is and what I mean is that some young people can drink to the point where they're completely alcohol poisoning or blacking out, and being able to you know, I think education in those cases would prevent that extreme amount. People would start drinking with less, you know, smaller doses. People with less weight would you know, learn to drink more moderately or say no, because, you know, they have to learn more about their bodies, but they're getting this education in the middle of a very high pressure, you know, sales pitch from their friends and would be, you know, lovers. So it's not the healthiest way to get an education. That's for sure.
True. And the phenomenon of binge drinking is alive and well on college campuses throughout this country and pretty much around this planet, where we've kind of excused that as a rite of passage. And God bless those who survive that rite of passage. And the number of people who actually overdose on alcohol is relatively low. It's still two people a day, which is a lot. But at the end of the ball game here, we're not talking greatly about those who overdose on the drug alcohol, but more of my emphasis is on the health impacts further down the road.
Yeah, so you're more about the effect of moderate drinking long term,
yes,
right?
Absolutely. If we and I look at the various health studies that come out, and particularly regarding cancer, and this is a known carcinogen. It's on the National Institute of Health list of known carcinogens, human carcinogens, not just in rats. And this is directly linked to 7 different types of cancer. And you just follow the path that it takes through your body, starting with your mouth. Alcohol consumption is the number 2 cause of oral cancers. Esophageal, stomach, liver, of course, pancreas, colon. And for ladies, this is the only dietary connection ever made to an increased risk for breast cancer, where one single drink a day increases your risk by double digits. And drinking more than 4 a day gives you the same risk as smoking a pack of cigarettes. So when I look at not just the overall study that is done linking the drug to cancer, but also looking at what kind of dosage was, and of course, the higher the dose, the greater the risk. Goes without saying that. But in this case, where you have oncologist after oncologist saying, even moderate drinking is too much risk for human consumption. So I gotta take that seriously. These are the guys who know cancer.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I would just add something to that, though, that I think a big part of this is what's emerging now as a customized medicine, sometimes called DNA medicine. You know, essentially, I mean, one of the best examples of this are studies of centurion, people who have lived over 100 years. Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of them drink constantly and smoke constantly, right? So it's not exactly a controlled experiment, but you ask yourself, well, why do these people live so damn long? Well, you know, the current consensus or belief is that there is, they have a higher tolerance of these things than perhaps other people. It's a lot like how, you know, Europeans, especially Northern Europeans, have a higher tolerance of milk because we've had it in our diet much longer. Whereas somebody of, you know, Native American descent has a much lower tolerance. Things like that are, I think, in the future going to slice this up even more. You know, and also there would be, there is some thought about a genetic or a predisposition to addiction. What do you think about that playing a role, that this, it might be, instead of everybody should watch out, it might be know yourself. Maybe the first ideal of the Greek, you know thyself before anything in excess, and maybe you're not right for it. Maybe somebody else can drink more and not have the consequences.
Right. I've studied a lot about the genetics and the link to the disease of alcoholism due to flaws in chromosomes 11q and 4f, and looking at the different the genome theory revealed a lot to us about what makes our body tick. But when you put that all into perspective, some people are born with this faulty gene package that makes them more prone to alcoholism. However, nobody became alcoholic without taking the first drink. Well, we're in a situation here in this country is that the age of first use is around 12. That's pretty astounding. So if we can push that back a little bit closer to the age of legal consumption, and as you know, all laws are it's a compromise. So we got to 21 from 18 because of compromise. And statistically, the brain keeps growing until you're 25. But hey, 12, it's still really, really growing. So how about we push that back a little bit and change the education. So regardless of what gene package you're gifted with, you've given your brain and your body a fighting chance to potentially stave off a deadly disease.
Yeah, no, I'm totally there with you. I'm less interested in kind of the statistical analysis because there are statistical anomalies and correlation is not always causation. It's a complex thing that we might discover more about later. But the data around youth drinking is absolutely, I think it's ironclad. You would be hard pressed to find a hole in it. Whereas if you drink somewhere around puberty, basically, or earlier, the chances of you being alcoholic is just astronomical. And if it's just mild exposure to alcohol, and it really is because the brain is growing, alcohol it does. Replace some of the chemistry, without getting too technical, some of the chemistry that your brain uses to function. So when it replaces that, your brain thinks it doesn't have to produce those things. A very similar reaction happens with nicotine. And that's where a lot of the addictiveness comes from, is you're missing out on something. Your brain feels like you're missing out. You have to go back to it again and again to get just to feel normal.
And that's one of the things, especially in the case of women, how they've looked at the earlier the onset of drinking between their first period and their first pregnancy, the closer it was to their first period, the more damage it does and the more it increases the risk of breast cancer. So you're entirely on the right path here. The earlier we're starting with this drug or this toxin, the more it's affecting body tissues, whether it's the gray matter upstairs in your prefrontal cortex, or in the case of women, affecting their exposure or their risk of breast cancer later on. Yeah. So looking at an age of first use around 12 is really setting yourself up. And I liken this to when you drink, it's not going to level you just like taking a lethal dose of fentanyl. But this is more like stepping out on the curb waiting for the truck to hit you. And it just might not hit you. I mean, you might have the gift of superior or super genes and not have any adverse health consequences down the road. Or in fact, you might suffer anything from learning disabilities on to something more sinister, such as the disease of cancer or stroke.
That's true. Well, I'll tell you an interesting story about me is I had some exposure to alcohol when I was 14 years old. I had a summer where I just was introduced to it from some friends. It's a Canadian thing where it was like bush parties and it was very plentiful. And I went crazy for, about a week or two. Like it was a very short period of time. And I totally went too far. I ended up puking and things like that. And I basically thought to myself, this sucks. And I stopped touching alcohol. And later on, when I grew older and I was legal in Canada, the legal drinking age is 18, but I still didn't drink right up until, you know, mid-20s, barely touched the stuff, just because I had such a bad experience, you know, early on. I thank, you know, I'm thankful that that bad experience didn't give me any sort of cravings or anything. I happily enjoy alcohol. Now I actually have a fun pastime where I take whiskey and I have an infuser and I add different flavors like vanilla and things like that and let it sit and, you know, but I'm the type that's like sipping it with ice a little bit at a time. I'm not, you know, binge drinking or, you know, chugging it. Right.
My first experience with alcohol also was at age 14. I am a person in long-term recovery from the disease of alcoholism. I was a late bloomer. My disastrous relationship, or should I say when alcohol turned on me, wasn't until I was in my 30s. I didn't even touch it hardly at all when I was in college because I was putting myself through college. So I didn't have an adverse experience as you did with my first or my formative years. It was just further down the road. So, and again, though the alcohol was connected with a bad experience for me, it was just way later.
Now I want to give some credit to alcohol a little bit. I think one of the reasons why there might be some challenging to your message, and I know you're not an abolitionist, but you know some people are. Some people want to go back to the days of temperance and everything, which I think is a huge step back and would just open up organized crime. And actually, there's a lot of evidence that actually, you know, prohibition actually increased the consumption of alcohol because all of a sudden it was bad, you know, and then more people wanted to do it, but. Going back in the history of humanity, alcohol has served an incredible social purpose. There's a lot of people who, starting off at the very beginning, it's believed that all the archaeological evidence points to the birthplace of civilization started with fermenting barley to create a type of mead. As far back as we know in the historical records, that was one of the first times that people actually started farming something because they wanted alcohol. And that means that they had to measure off the space that they were farming. The original thought was that they were creating bread. And now we know that bread actually came many hundreds of years, if not thousands of years later. Because there was so much barley, some people thought of, hey, what else could we do with it other than make this beautiful drink? But it actually started off with alcohol. And then, of course, you know, when people are farming this stuff, that means they have to protect it. So you create property rights, government, borders. That means it led to the creation of what we now think of as math and writing. And that, of course, led to all forms of civilization. Even most of modern medicine is based on you know, the attempts in the past of improving distillation methods. So there's a really great documentary on this, on how, you know, beer created civilization made in the UK. And I just think it's that sort of nostalgia that we know that there is a benefit. We know that there is a social benefit, it ties people together, things like that. I think that's where the idea of moderation really does come from. And I think that's why there's a lot of blowback from some of these recent studies and these recent claims that any amount of alcohol is dangerous to the person, you know? Mm-hmm.
And I think if people know that risk, if they know that going into their relationship with alcohol, then I've accomplished what I set out to do. What I love to hear about the history, and I've seen this documentary as well. You know, you look at ancient times and ancient civilizations. For some of them, this was the only potable drink that they had available to them.
Yeah. The people who built the pyramids, they were paid in wine. But that wine, although it had some alcohol content, very, very small by today's standards, it actually had vitamins, it had antibiotics and everything, and it was fed to children. Least we could say is those were different times. But, you know, even going back to the more modern era, I know the St. Lawrence Canal was dug mostly by Irish people and Irish men, I should say. And they were paid in whiskey daily. That was one of their biggest rations. So this is a this is a fairly well-known phenomenon, but you're absolutely right. For the longest time, it was the only drink that was healthy. You'd die from just, you know, drinking water.
Mm-hmm. And today, if we look at all of the other political discussions that are taking place here in the United States, especially regarding healthcare, if we have 20 to 40% of our general use hospital beds going to the treatment of alcohol-related complications, then this alcohol consumption also needs to be part of this dialogue, whether it's overconsumption, as we've already discussed, or, you know, at what level is this safe? The doctor, the scientists, the oncologists say no level. And I think there's always been spirited conversation everywhere that I've spoken that, well, you know, there has to be some level that's permissible, acceptable, without tragic risk. And so this is another part of the dialogue that needs to be exposed when we're having the conversation about alcohol as well. While it may benefit the society, it's also hurting in some regard our access to healthcare. Another wild piece of statistical information: two hospital admissions every single minute are alcohol related. Wow, yeah. What does that say about the access to healthcare? Well, it means there's several hundred hospital admissions every minute. But here's a part of what's driving the costs of up to $250 billion every year in the United States. So it's a discussion, a lively discussion point every time I go out and speak.
I think actually it's really, yeah, this is a really good idea. It's really important to focus on education too. And I wish more effort was put towards, we have, you know, driving tests and things like that where people learn all about a car, but they don't learn, you know, when you had that drink, now you're starting to feel a little tipsy and your reaction time is not going to be that great. And I study all this stuff just because I'm fascinated about brain science, and I could rhyme off a ton of things that alcohol does and doesn't do to the brain, but the average person doesn't know that. And knowing your limits is really important. I think the future though, is that customized approach. There is a safe limit for some. And I think that's going to be a tough pill to swallow, that there is not a safe limit for others. And they're going to, because, so if you take a stat, let's say we come up with some sort of stat that X number of percentage of people, get cancer. And then when you add alcohol, that percentage goes higher. That does not mean that it affected everybody in the sample group the same. So let's say if you even broke it up into people who can handle alcohol genetically and people who can't, if that one group that can't handle alcohol, if their risk goes up by, say, 20 points, then when you do that full sample of everybody, the risk for everybody only goes up by 10 points. It may actually be that the high risk group is just much higher risk than we think, and the low risk group is not. And that's what I think the future will discover, because we're vastly underestimating how much our genes, our nature, our history take a role in all of this, I think.
Mm-hmm. The human body has proven to be resilient, resoundingly resilient, and in that it defies a lot of the things we put it through. And you're right. What is the measure, and also how is it enforced, is going to be a really interesting part of the horizon of healthcare and the horizon of public policy in the years to come.
Yeah, and I think also, part of this debate is going to come out over the next few years with pot use. I mean, I'm originally from Canada. I live in Canada now, and they just legalized poorly, badly. The government did it horribly by everyone's estimation, but they did it. So many more places in the States have become legal. They referred to pot. There was a lot of pseudoscience around the idea that pot was a gateway drug to other things. And again, you know, correlation is not causation make. I'm wondering how pot and the legalization of it fit into your framework. Do you think that, again, this is another drug that we're not educated enough on?
I think there's a generous amount of misinformation around marijuana right now. I think it's a different drug than when I was growing up. I never used marijuana. I could always get where I wanted to with alcohol. So this wasn't part of my youth or my experience here. But in the research for Look What Dragged the Cat In, one of the suggested solutions was more exposure or more access to marijuana, so then people wouldn't be using opioids in search of pain relief. And I think definitely, absolutely, this drug, marijuana, the THC or the cannabidiols in there, I mean, we need to look at what the pain relief properties are and what the health consequences are side by side. I think that it's worth looking into anything that's going to prolong life, if that is indeed what marijuana is going to do.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And I would also put in herbs like kratom and morningside, things that kratom's a big one that people are using to get off opiates, and it's a very mild herb that's related to the coffee plant and can relieve a lot of pain without giving a feeling of being high. Although it has been very controversial, as everything is in the United States, because people have cut it with all sorts of other stuff misused it and misrepresented it. So I think that a lot of these things need to be part of the public discussion, and we need to have a mature discussion about how much is too much and how much is not enough. You know, if you're, I suffered from chronic pain for many, many, many years. Alcohol didn't really do anything for me for chronic pain. Right. So I guess I never really, was able to get addicted to it. I've been using kratom lately. It's been fantastic. But I've also done a lot of physiotherapy, and I don't have the pain that I used to, physiotherapy and yoga changed my life that way. But I would not fault somebody for turning to a substance if it would took their pain away. I would just say that, make sure that it's not something that gives you another form of pain, like alcohol would not be a very good pain reliever, in my opinion. Certainly a social lubricant, a sleep aid sometimes, in moderate amounts. Take a little nightcap if you're having difficulty sleeping, can be wonderful, but if you're doing that for pain relief, that is a big mistake.
Definitely. Interesting you should mention sleep. It's a great sleep aid to get you down, but it also robs you of your rapid eye movement, your REM sleep. So you might be getting to sleep quicker, but your quality of sleep isn't going to be. That's when your body's restoring itself.
Now, is that from like drinking till you pass out, or is that just the one or two shot nightcap to kind of relax you?
That's the two shot nightcap. In fact, that was the figure two beverages. So in the alcohol world, that's your 14 ounce wine, your 12 ounce beer.
Interesting. Yeah, a lot of people swear by that. That's interesting to know. I'd love to see the link on that. If you send that off to us, we'll put it in the links down underneath this video. And I want to thank you very much for being on the show. This has been enlightening.
Much appreciated. Thank you, Dave. Appreciate the show.
Oh, and I got to say, your book is fantastic. I was looking through it the other day. I love the title. It's very catchy, and I strongly recommend it to anybody who, it's not just like you're not giving it to somebody that's just going to scold them about alcohol. It'll actually educate them about alcohol, and when they consume, they'll do it a lot more intelligently. So I got to say, the book is very well written.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for listening to The Brains Behind It. And remember to check out brainhackers.com for more. If you have a suggestion for the next interview or comment, please email editor@brainhackers.com. If you want a free 30-minute marketing consultation from Dave Farrow and his team, then email editor@brainhackers.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.